represents a people that suffered genocide at the hands of people that were wearing uniforms of different, you know, federal forces of the United States government.
Rigo, before we wrap up, you traveled the country to bring the statue to American University, which had originally been approved, and you had people stand in his feet, the feet of the sculpture, all through the country, including Standing Rock?
Correct. Standing Rock and Pine Ridge and the Alcatraz Island in San Francisco, you know, here in Los Angeles in a community school, in El Sereno, and so more than 500 people have stood on those feet to demonstrating their solidarity with Leonard Peltier and sharing his journey, sharing his path.
If people want to see our conversation with Martin Garbus, one of his attorneys who is pushing for clemency for Leonard Peltier, you can go to democracynow.org. Rigo 23, thanks so much for joining us. Rigo is a California-based political artist.
Thank
you. 9-foot-tall statue of Leonard Peltier is now being removed from the campus of American University, though it was originally approved. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of First 100 Days, United in Resistance. First 100 Days is a resource to support creative resistance to the Trump regime and takes place January 14th and 15th at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. There will be workshops on preparing for protests, interrupting oppression, creative protest tactics, and more, with the goal of strengthening our communities by channeling outrage into dynamic projects based on a deeper analysis of anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and feminist histories. Again, that's First 100 Days, January 14th and 15th at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, 415 Southwest 10th Avenue, Suite 300 in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Some of them were dreamers, some of them were fools, who were making plans and thinking of the future. And with the energy of the innocent, they were gathering the tools they would need to make their journey back to nature. And their hands reach for the golden ring. With their hearts they turn to each other's hearts for refuge. In the troubled years that came before the deluge,
some of them knew pleasure and some of them knew pain. And for some of them, it was only the moment that mattered. And on the brave and crazy wings of youth, they went flying around in the rain, till their feathers, once so fine, grew torn and tattered. And in the end, they traded the tired wings for the resignation that living brings, and exchange love's bright and fragile glow for the glitter in the rouge. And in a moment they were swept before the deluge.
let the music keep us.
And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBO Community Radio. Coming at you, Southeast Portland. Yeah, there's a song for all you other boomers out there. Probably for you a few years older than me anyway. Anyway, before the deluge, I guess you get the meaning of that song. So here we are again. I had a couple possible guests fall through here at the last minute. And I got to tell you, without getting too confessional, I've been having some health issues and just kind of some general malaise issues. I don't know how many other people are feeling it. I don't want to lay it completely at the hands of this recent electoral debacle. I think I was just listening to another radio station on my way in briefly, and they're talking about stress and cortisol. I do believe I've been, without really realizing it, under a lot of stress the last few weeks, couple months. Not just the election, all things sort of added together. And anyway, I developed this, as I say, without getting all too confessional, inflammation of my duodenum. Actually, I've had it for two or three decades. I don't know if other people out there have these sort of weak spots in our body-mind unities that flare up when we're under stress. Well, that's mine. And boy, it's messing with my sleep, which messes with the rest of my life. So I guess that's one thing we can talk about, how people are feeling what's going on in our bodies, in our spirits, in our emotional bodies. It's hard times. We all know it. We need to support each other. And before I go on, speaking of supporting each other, I need to read this. Some really horrible news. A homeless man was found dead from hypothermia in Portland on Monday night. I'm sure most of you have probably heard this already. Actually just past where I live out in East Portland. The man was identified as 51-year-old Mark Elliott Johnson. His last known address was in Hillsboro. Just want to read a little bit about this. Anyone who sees someone outside and unsheltered with their life in apparent danger or in need of immediate medical help, or just if you're just not really sure, you might ask them, you know, if they don't seem really aware that they're underdressed and not prepared for the weather, you can call 911. That's what our emergency services are for. In other situations, again, I'm going back to reading from this news report. In other situations, such as seeing someone outside not being dressed for the weather, well, that's what I just said, conditions, call the, okay, so they're saying if you see someone you feel is not properly dressed for the weather conditions, call the non-emergency police line at 503-823-3333. Again, that's 503-823-3333 and request a welfare check for that person. So if you see someone who's in immediate danger and seems to be struggling visibly, call 911 right away. If you're not quite sure, if you just think they could use a check from our public agencies, which are designed to do this, call that non-emergency police line. You can also call 211 to assist someone in finding shelter and transportation to a shelter. That's 211 to assist someone in finding shelter and transportation to a shelter. I'm going to leave these numbers if we don't already have them up at the front desk. We got another few days of bitter cold, people, so let's watch out for each other. Warming centers are open in Portland and Gresham with capacity during the day and night. Apparently, I've already got a couple callers. So if you just hold on a second. People seeking to get warm, especially during daytime hours, are encouraged to utilize public buildings that are open to the public, including libraries and community centers. So if you are listening and you are a houseless in a houseless situation, and you might be generally reticent to do that for fear of whatever, please take care of yourselves. And it also ends with a quote: as freezing temperatures are expected to continue this week, Portland police officers will be actively looking for and checking on vulnerable people and facilitating transportation to warming shelters as needed. So that's that. Don't need any more deaths from the cold. I just want to briefly talk about the program last week and just sort of try to succinctly express what I was getting at and sort of lead into today's conversation. So it's kind of led off by, obviously, the election and my tendency to look at things in what I consider a deeper historical perspective rather than just reacting to which we need to do. And sometimes these can work together and sometimes they might be in tension with each other. But to look at a little bit of the deeper roots for what we're facing. So I've been reading this book, American Leviathan, Empire, Nation, and Revolutionary Frontier by Patrick Griffin. It came out in 2007. It's, I think, just a brilliant relook at the pre-revolutionary and revolutionary and immediate post-revolutionary period and how that formed the kind of national character, national psychology. Are these things real of this country? Especially the expansion, the fight over the Ohio River Valley, where my ancestors both fought in the what's called Lord Dunmore's War, and in the French and Indian Wars, an ancestor in the Virginia Militia. So that's a part of my karma that I'm dealing with. It's part of our national karma as well. So I think it is also good if you are European American like me to dig into your own family history roots and understand where you came from as part of our decolonizing anti-imperialist efforts together with the people who were either brought here, whose families were brought here against their will, enslaved, or whose families were indigenous to this land, or whose families were some perhaps brought here as virtually indentured servants from other countries, or whose families were immigrants seeking escape from whatever or seeking opportunity. All of us together are facing this situation, and we need to figure out quick the vantage point from which we are looking at the situation and our own personal and family histories that with which we bring to bear to this situation, and how we all can potentially work together and help each other. So I was talking about American Leviathan, and basically the thesis is that there's these deep historical things, these traumas, if you were, these psychological characteristics, and he cites this character, Tom Quick, whose family was, his father was killed by a Delaware man, and I haven't gotten to where the author describes the context within which that occurred, which is exactly what these white nationalists who are feeling their oats now with Trump's election, who forget the context within which the United States nation was forged. Anyway, so that psychology is still with us today, that reactionary psychology. And without getting back into that discussion of that period, time period, that's what I was attempting to do. And I also cited a couple articles, including A White Nationalist Counter-Revolution by another historian, Gregory Smithers. And he was going to be one of my possible guests he's going to be a future guest. He said he was busy this morning actually giving testimony on a local Virginia Native American issue. That's one of his areas of expertise. He's a very interesting figure. He's an Australian, so he has an understanding of settler colonialism from an Australian perspective, the history of the Australian Aboriginal people being very similar, and the whole ideological context of the imposition of the Australian state on the indigenous peoples there being very similar, just like South Africa, to the United States. So that's what I was going, and what I was thinking about since then is this tension, as I said, between needing to come to grips with a radical historical perspective, as I call it, meaning going to the roots and understanding that what we're dealing with has very, very deep, the institutions are steeped in this racist and classist history. And it's not, we can't just pass incremental reforms to deal with that. Something more is required. There's something very fundamentally askew from the very establishment of this country. At the same time, passing and fighting for incremental reforms wins us the space, and especially the people who are most dramatically and disastrously impacted by the racist and classist nature of this society, wins people some respite from police violence, from workplace violence, from inequalities of pay, from gender violence, from all these things. So that's what I was trying to lay out. That's what I would like to continue talking about today. And also wouldn't mind talking a little bit about anxiety and stress, which is, again, what I've been feeling. And I also want to point to a new article by Chris Hedges defying Donald Trump's kleptocracy. Because another thing that I talked about, and I know I'm adding things to the plate here, but bear with me. So one of the other directions I was going in with the show was what I've discussed and other people have discussed is the seeming fascist nature of the incoming regime and the way that it seems to be intent on dismantling the rule of law. And there's at least a couple ways of dealing with corruption. One is to actually confront it, to address it head on through the rule of law. Another is to actually dismantle the rule of law. And basically that's what fascism did. Fascism being basically a reaction to not only the terrible crises of capitalism in the early part of the 20th century, but a draconian reaction to the working people's attempt to restructure and overturn the existing capitalist system, which was perhaps had its strongest expression just before World War I. So, is it going to be fascism, or as Hedges also talks about, is the sort of a certain farcical nature? Is it going to be like Karl Marx said, history repeats itself first as tragedy and then as farce? Or is it going to be some terrible combination? So, that's a lot to put out there. So let's go to our first caller at 503-231-8187, which I believe is Camilo, one of our regular callers. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. You have laid out a fabric that has a lot of different threads, some of which are tangled, some of which are dangling. I'm going to try to see how I can weave my way through this. And I think it's possible to weave them all together into a single fabric.
Well, I think they're already woven together. It's just how do we perceive that?
Well, I think in order to perceive that, you have to see where and how it's woven together, and whether or not they should be woven together, and whether or not it makes sense to you as a total fabric. And I think I can do that because I represent, in terms of the whole question of identity, an interesting combination myself that has to do with many of these threads. First of all, I'm a physician. I'm a psychiatrist. So I can speak to some of those issues around anxiety that you raise. Second of all, I am a person whose heritage is colonial. My family is from the former British West Indies, Trinidad and Tobago, which became a nation state in the 60s. And one interesting phenomena about that is, you know, you could say according to current identity politics that I'm black. But West Indians, I think, represent a different kind of blackness because they come from an area where they were in the majority and they assumed the reins of power in government, not entirely, because economic power, of course, is retained in the hands of the dominant culture, but they were able to manage to have, I guess, a sense of expectations about what they deserved. And I think that's something that immigrants from the West Indies brought with them to this country, where they encountered the racism that we have here. And perhaps that difference in experience gave them a different perspective and a different set of attitudes about what to expect and what they deserve. So I am privileged in that respect. And I think that sort of privilege gives you a lot of advantages in terms of what you demand from the society. And also, I am a Buddhist. I've been practicing Buddhism for the past year, and that brings another perspective that covers some of the questions that you raise about how do we respond to these questions about, you know, what our karma is and what our responsibility that our karma gives us towards the current situation. And the first thing I want to say is I think that with regard to the anxiety that many of us are feeling, I have begun to experience myself. And I realized that shortly after the election, I was feeling very confident, let me put it that way, because I felt like my Buddhism gave me a perspective that sort of transcended some of the more immediate issues. But since then, I've gotten depressed, and I'm not sure about that feeling that I had. And I realized that, still consistent with Buddhism, that perhaps what we need to do is to be honest with ourselves and recognize these pains that we are experiencing as a result of the election. And instead of rushing off into some sort of action to come to grips with the pain and the suffering before we make up our minds about, well, we have to do this and we have to do that, I think we have to recognize where we're at and also recognize where our struggle is, and to approach it with a degree of compassion for ourselves and for the circumstances we're struggling with.
You know, everything you're saying resonates with me. One thing that I think of a lot is sort of like really the deep underpinning of that I've got to in my thought is, I guess one critique I always had, and I know it's probably a superficial critique of Buddhism through the individuals that I've encountered, many of them tended to take a very individual perspective, whereas what I see is what we're really faced with is this need to really overcome this. Obviously, we need to, you know, we're all individuals. We need to, you know, deal with our individuality, obviously. But what we've really lost, it seems to me, is the deeper, you know, some people call it tribal, the deeper community connections. And obviously the fact that there's homeless people dying on the street, or at least one on Monday, is an indication that, you know, if anybody walks around and keeps their eyes open and sees this, which I do, you know, riding my bike around, the number of, whether it's in Sullivan's Gulch or, you know, here in inner southeast Portland or wherever, the homeless camps and tent structures set up, we've obviously, we realize something is completely awry, and we feel overwhelmed by that. And so we tend to retreat to what we know best, which is our, you know, our own individual response to things. And somehow we've really got to come to grips with that. And, you know, I know there are people who form political groups, people who form clubs, people who form different associations, people who are involved in, you know, whatever organizations. That's obviously a way of doing it. And I think through that, we need to really come to grips with some of these, you know, there's this thing, this narcissism of little differences, which I feel really strongly that we tend to sort of amplify the differences between ourselves, you know, because we're so highly individualized. Anyway, I know I've thrown a bunch of other things out there, but that's, I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I entirely agree with your response to what I said, because that is my concern also. And let me just close with you by saying that, as you pointed out last week, that we all need to step up. And the way that I see the need to step up as a Buddhist is precisely what you point out, is that we have to not only deal with our own consciousness, but we have to, with that consciousness, reach out to others. And I think essentially, whereas many Buddhists may believe that it's necessary to work on your own consciousness before you can address the general society's consciousness, I think you have to ask yourself the question, can you really be free until all other people are free?
All right.
And what I am doing to facilitate that is I've organized, together with other people in my Sangha, the Shambhala Climate Practice Action Group, where we will discuss these types of questions very directly and explicitly. And we will be having our first meeting January 11th at Shambhala, and all are welcome to attend.
And what's Shambhala? Where's Shambhala?
Shambhala is a Buddhist Sangha that's located at 1110 Southwest Adler Street. And
okay. And what time is that?
It will be at 7:15 in the evening.
Okay. Thank you so much. You said Alder or Adler?
Adler. No, wait a minute. Alder. I always get those mixed up. Alder.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you for catching that. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. And that was Camilo, a regular caller. I encourage regular and new callers, if you haven't called in, we can do without that dial tone. Please call in at 503-231-8187. And Ruth is on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air. Are you still with us?
Will always be my hero for bringing Guy McPherson to Portland August 8th. And I appreciate you setting up your program with our historical information, which we did not get spoon-fed through our school textbooks. And most people don't understand radio, talk show. It's not a platform for people to give their whole history or everything they believe in. But in the Buddhist tradition, yes, of course, know yourself, as even Shakespeare said. So for any of us in this trepidation we feel, is first self-care. Get grounded. Be real. Be honest with yourself, because you can't really bring compassion to the wider circumstance. But writers have a saying, get out of your own way. You set up a great format, as your listener said, your guest speaker last week. Let's not call ourselves radical. We're holding the space for common sense. We're not being radical.
Yeah, but what do you mean? What do you mean by radical?
Well, last week, the guest, one of the guest speakers you had, I think he was on the phone as a speaker for your show last week.
Right, I understand.
Cautioned you not to call yourself or any of us radicals.
Well, but maybe we mean something different. Maybe we mean something different by radical. The point I made is that the root of the word radical means to the root of things. That's what I use the term radical in terms.
Right,
if you're
right,
if you're using the term, if you're using
in
radical
in regular vernacular, we know that like Bush Senior hated Portland, that whole crazy West Coast, Left Coast.
We don't want to fall in though to that.
It has negative.
Right, but we don't want to let them reclaim the language. That's what I'm trying to bring it back to what it actually means. You know?
Right, right, right. But as your guest speaker you had last week, just we need to be conscious of our words. So I'm just saying I agree with your guest speaker last week. If we think we're being radical by saying, hey, look, we're... these laws are scary. They're buying into the divide and conquer, and we need to stand up for all of us in common sense. And I will finish with last week, Joe and Abe had a show, their Tuesday show, where they limited every caller to 2 minutes. And the energy, the momentum of that show was great. It was far different. There were more callers. And so, as I said, the woman that said last week to you, it isn't what you know, it's what you do. I disagreed that you said she didn't bring anything to the table. I think she did. With that, I'll hang up.
Okay. Well,
and again, I thank you.
All right. Because, thank you.
Take care, Paul, because you are, you're a pillar. So this is time not to fix every caller, but just to let them speak and truly take care.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think we disagree on that issue of radical, but that's okay. I think actually the caller last week actually may have reconsidered their position after I explained my view of what the term radical. I think what people confuse is the term radical with extremist, I believe, is what it is. And so I'm just saying a radical analysis is one that actually gets to the root of the matter, that is goes deeper. And I think that that's what people in power fear, and why people who really are radical get labeled as extremists. So with that, let's go to our next caller. LJ, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Happy New Year.
Uh-huh.
All right. So here's the deal, Paul. In the Buddhist tradition, I've been following the teachings of the Buddha for maybe 35, 40 years now. I consider myself a Jubu because I'm Jewish, but I also follow the Buddhist tradition. And it's called attachment, Paul. If you hold on, one of the people I studied Zen with said, and I quote, holding on to life is like holding on to a chainsaw. The only thing that you can do is get cut, right? And so it's actually only the moment that matters. As far as me personally, I'm more optimistic now than I've been in years. The flag of Palestine is flying at Standing Rock. The millennials are connecting the dots. It's all of this caca that we have to put up with is like all connected, right? And I'd like to recommend a book, a companion book. It's called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America by Nancy Isenberg. I'm with the Radical Elders Reading Group. We meet over at, in other words, every Thursday from 1 to 2:30. And this is the book that we are now reading.
Yeah, I've heard of that book. I always that sounded really interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Paul, it's absolutely, absolutely incredible. Because this country was settled by what the Brits called wasted people, refuge, people that they didn't want to see on the street. The Brits referred to them as garbage. So what they did was they sent their garbage over here to settle the U.S. And then it kind of takes it from there. And it's a very, very good read, very, very interesting history. The Aussies, same situation, settled by convicts and just disposable people that the Brits had absolutely no taste for at all.
Of course, and you're talking about the early phases of English colonization. Of course, it has a much more complex history as time goes on. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, listen, thanks for that. That's another addition.
Nothing to it, Paul. Anyway, keep on keeping on. And Paul, keep it real, man.
All right.
Have a good day.
Do my best. Thank you, LJ. Bye-bye. And we got another caller. Jan is on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey there. This is pretty funny because I thought about calling in. I was too late when the radical, like, little intellectual kind of static was brewing the last time, and I'm a Jubu that lives way up in Zigzag, and I guess I'm sort of a borderline was intellectual. My grandpa died under the willow trees and did the holy book Jewish thing, and I'm thinking about doing, I thought it was a great idea about doing a local newsletter or in the newspaper in the Mountain Times called Zigzag Zeitgeist, but I just wanted to share with you one thing. Besides the fact that it's great that you can listen, and then we can, like, my idea is with people that live up here, some, like, borderline polarized intellectual artists and then kind of redneck kind of people, be thinking that we're all the common ground is kind of hanging in there and helping each other out. Sometimes the thought, the mental kind of cerebral people don't help you out as much as if you can develop ways to talk to people that haven't really gone as far intellectually, but still the same points hold true for all of us. And I wanted to just share this one point about Buddhism. You can kind of blow it off, and there's this kind of Buddhism and that kind of Buddhism. But the Buddhism I practice, the Herbie Hancock, Tina Turner, let's study and practice and act on what study, the study of the correct teaching, which rises up again and again and again, is as bad as things get. The point is, there's not two lands, good and evil. The purity of the mind of the people, and that we can develop ourselves by studying. We study the Lotus Sutra, the teaching of how people can actually get along and live a happy life and purify their senses and clear their minds and act properly, correctly, in a kind way to each other so that we can relate. And so I think this talk show is great that Cable has a forum, you know, like a possibility where you can be bright and I can be bright, but we can listen and kind of get on the same wavelength about how we can relate to each other. And here I can be a Jubu living way up in my zeitgeist up in Zigzag, but that we all have the capacity as ordinary people or advancing along the possibilities through listening and thinking about. Yes, maybe it's super radical to be thinking that we can, like, really sprout and change and grow together and not just study semiotics, but that we can, at the root, find some accord that it matters that we were born human beings, that we can change ourselves by sharing perceptions. And, yeah, so anyhow.
Hey, well, thanks for that. But thanks, you know,
thanks so much for listening. And it's a
I just wanted to respond a little bit. Actually,
yes,
have a conversation. I just think it's interesting that you're from Zigzag. I know that a little bit. I part of the Earth First forest battles took place up there in Rhododendron, not too far away. So and of course you pass through Zigzag going up Highway 26. We all see it as we go up towards Mount Hood, maybe not stop so much. But anyway, you know, in small communities like that, my feeling is you know, you sometimes you can probably have like lifetime feuds and maybe just like not, you know, one way is just not to speak to somebody because you have to see them all the time. So if you just don't like them, but another way is you're forced to like deal with them. Whereas in the big anonymous city, you know, even in, you know, the smaller, you know, the neighborhoods, it's a lot easier just to sort of shine people on and just sort of not deal with each other. So I thought it was interesting that
Yeah, totally. I was like that in New York. I'm just like a replant from Brooklyn. But come up and have a pint with me up at the Skyway sometime, okay?
Okay. Thank you for that. All right. Well, thanks for calling. And our next caller up is Linda. Oh, wait, before we go to Linda, let me just say that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, there will be the fifth and final part of the series, Black Power, 50 Years in D.C., and a look at the Black Arts Movement. I got to say, I've found those things really fascinating myself. I've been listening anyway. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, the FBI pressures American University to take down a sculpture of Leonard Peltier. We just heard about that on Democracy Now! Also look at billionaire Betsy DeVos, Trump's pick for Secretary of Education. At 11, the bike show will dive into the dynamics that can make a bike shop great and what can make them so intimidating. And of course, thank all our KBOO members for your ongoing and generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO.fm and clicking on donate. And we got 20 minutes left. 2350-323-1881-87 is the number. We're just going all over the place. I tend to, on these shows where I go solo, I tend to set a topic or a general framework. Of course, today I sort of scattershot a little bit, and then people take it from there. But Harry, go ahead. What have you got to contribute?
Oh, greetings and thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to your show for quite some time, but in the last 5-6 months, you've been giving us information about Standing Rock, and I want to thank you for all you've done for the movement, because I found a lot more information from your show. And now that Standing Rock is over,
it's not over. No, hopefully next week when hopefully Jacqueline Keeler, my once a month co-host, will be back on, and I assume she'll be wanting to talk about that. But no, it's the Army Corps of Engineers denied the easement for pulling the pipe underneath Lake Oahe, the Missouri River. But they're able to, from what I understand, continue drilling up to that point, and they've laid all the rest of the pipes. They're not giving it up. There's also funders that have pulled out. It's a very complex situation, but it's, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the Trump administration. Can they, will they reverse? There's still litigation going on in court. Oh no, this thing is far from over.
Well, maybe this is what's causing how you're feeling. I mean, maybe you're suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, because you had to deal with this for the last 5 months, given this report.
Well,
and it was very violent. There was violence there also.
Well, it's very that would be a very indirect case of PTSD, but let's leave that there. I mean, we could explore these things. You know, I think we're all traumatized by this culture.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we're all suffering.
And in the election also, no one really expected Trump really to win. And everyone's kind of the anxiety is the future. What's you know, what's going to happen. I mean, shall we work with Trump? I mean, he considers what he's doing a grassroots movement, you know. And
well, I think working with who, you know, you might consider some of his grassroots supporters is one thing. Working with him is another thing, but that's a big question. So, I mean, I think, he, you know, as I said, my feeling is their goal is basically to get into power through lies and manipulation, and then to just advance the ruthless, you know, agenda of late stage capitalism, which can't stand any more regulation because the profit margins tend to dwindle. So they have to keep doing what Reagan did, what Bush did, and do it to an even more extreme degree, is my view.
Okay, well, hopefully it won't happen. We really don't know what Trump is really going to do. He does have a 10-point plan for America, and just reading through that, well, some we can agree, some maybe we can help him save face.
Well, I must totally disagree with you. I think we have to take seriously the potential analogy, whether it's an exact one or not, with the way that fascist and Nazi regimes came into power. Hitler was elected. I mean, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think we have to take very seriously the possibility. I think he's in fundamentally bad faith, and to give him the possibility of having good faith, I think, is dangerous.
Okay, well, that's all I have, and I want to thank you for all you've done for KBOO.
All right. Well,
thank you. Nice day.
Okay, you too. I mean, I guess we could discuss that, but with 15 minutes left, I think it would be very difficult to go there. Do we have any more callers? We don't have any more callers, so you can be a caller at 503-231-8187. Otherwise, you'll have to just listen to me. So Chris Hedges, as I said, wrote this new article, Defying Donald Trump's Kleptocracy, which means a thievery. So let me just read a little bit of this. Chris Hedges always, whether you like his style of writing, whether you agree with him, I tend to. He definitely is very lively and gives us much food for thought. The final stages of capitalism, Karl Marx predicted, would be marked by global capital being unable to expand and generate profits at former levels. Kind of just like I was saying. Capitalists would begin to consume the government along with the physical and social structures that sustain them. Democracy, social welfare, electoral participation, the common good, and investment in public transportation, roads, bridges, utilities, industry, education, ecosystem protection, and healthcare would be sacrificed to feed the mania for short-term profit. These assaults would destroy the host. This is the stage of late capitalism that Donald Trump represents. Trump plans to oversee the last great campaign of corporate pillaging of America. It will be as crass and brazen as the fleecing of the desperate people, hoping for a miracle in the face of dead-end jobs and ruinous personal debt, who visited his casinos or shelled out thousands of dollars for the sham of Trump University. He will attempt to unleash a kleptocracy. The word comes from the Greek klepto, meaning thieves, and kratos, meaning rule. So it is literally rule by thieves. One that will rival the kleptocracies carried out by Suharto in Indonesia and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. It is not that Trump and his family will use the influence of government to increase their wealth, although this will certainly take place on a massive scale. It is that hundreds of billions of federal dollars will be diverted into the hands of cronies, sleazy bankers, unethical financial firms, and scabrous hedge fund managers. The pillars of the liberal state will be obliterated. The only possibility for halting the destruction being designed by the Trump transition team is sustained resistance and civil disobedience that will create popular pressure for impeachment. This is why I will be at the march in Washington, D.C. on January 21st and speak that evening at a rally with Kshama Sawant and Jill Stein. Trump is impulsive, ignorant, and inept. His corruption and greed are so unfettered, he may become a burden and embarrassment to his party and the nation, as well as a danger to himself. The longer he stumbles in the unfamiliar corridors of governmental power, the more vulnerable he becomes. But if we are not in the streets to hold the system accountable, he may not be able to cling to power and inflict significant change. He may be able to cling to power and inflict significant change. And it goes on for a few more pages. That's on Truth Dig. I'm sorry, they're different. on January 1st, defying Donald Trump's kleptocracy. And it looks like Linda's back. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi. Paul?
I guess it's not Linda. Who is this? Mike? Go ahead.
Hi, Paul. I wasn't planning on calling, but you ran out of callers, but it's been an amazing show. And I don't know if I consider myself a Jubu, but I am. I am Jewish, and I certainly like Buddhist thought. I'm not exactly an intellectual, but I really like the idea. I've always embraced being real with people of every stripe. And I do think, there was a previous caller made a comment about having a 2-minute show.
2-minute callers.
Where Abe and Joe, I guess, had really short calls. Huh? There was a previous show, Paul, that it was at night, and I was really surprised to hear a talk show at night, and I think it was called Kitchen Coffee Talk or something along those lines, where that host allowed the callers to just talk, and then she just asked the most insightful questions and then gave them even more time, and it seemed like everyone had the time to really get to she just pulled out some surprising insights. So I love Tabu.
Yeah, well, there's the tension between, you know, an hour-long talk show is very difficult. I envy Tom Hartman, who has a 3-hour talk show, and you can feel it in the way he approaches it. He feels much more relaxed, and his listeners often feel relaxed. And it would be nice to, you know, I'm not advocating we go to a 24-hour talk show. I think there'd be a general rebellion, and I think the cultural music, everything that we offer is extremely valuable, but there's only 24 hours in a day and there's only an hour in our morning talk show. And so I think you put your finger on something very interesting. It's basically just the constraints of the format.
Right. Everyone, I find that I have a, I try to get my voice out and certainly in this format, I'm trying to get as much said as possible, and really I find it just takes time to get to for myself, certainly, I think most people would agree, to get to the point. I circle around the issues, but
we don't naturally think in sound bites, that's for sure.
I will say, as far as the current situations, I've go back to what I've always said. I think that there's room for meeting ground. When you were talking about radical, I understand that was a great point, but radical or extremists on both ends of as a leftist, I feel like there's room for conversations with people that have different views, because I think when I tuned in, you were making the point that we all have so many different views to begin with.
Well, my point was there that because the nature of individualism and the nature of and mass culture, how we aren't really grounded in like strong sort of collective traditions like some other ethnic tribal groups historically are, that there's something about the nature of this culture that we tend to sort of spin this whole very individualist mind world through the sort of accretion of our tastes in music, in film, in our family experience, our life experience. So we get highly individualized in these very idiosyncratic ways that make it difficult for us to resonate directly. That's why we have difficulty in relationships. I could get into that in great detail. That was my point, is that we inhabit these very individualized mental worlds that don't tend to easily jive. And then when we're socialized in our families or however we come to be in some sort of particular political perspective than if we say are in the left end versus the right end, we tend to like clash. And unless we like live in a small community like Jan was talking about in Zigzag, where we're forced to deal with each other on a real way, on a sort of daily basis, and get over some of these things and maybe find out what we're like as human beings, it's so easy for us just to sort of be repelled from each other and not have anything to do with each other.
I wish it was that easy for myself. I have so many relationships and work, and I'm going to leave it at that. I feel that communication, and I just love KBOO, and I want to hear more of what you all have to say.
Okay. Well, thank you. And of course, I'm kind of unique in that, I'm a volunteer here, but I don't spend immense amounts of time at KBOO, and I don't have a work situation that also would force me to deal with people. So obviously there are many other contexts. I'm sort of speaking maybe from my own idiosyncratic point of view. But anyway, I was reading from Chris Hedges, and the number to call is 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Linda Paul. Thanks for your show. I wanted to get back to the discussion of radical, and as you pointed out, to the root. And in my era and today myself, I'm proud to be a radical because it means I rejected at the root, the system of capitalism. Now, I don't have all our solutions, and I believe that radicals and non-radicals and all sorts of us can join together to fight fascism, which is what we're really on the brink of. And he's not pulling any punches combining, combining his own wealth and the wealth of capital with the U.S. government to support it is directly out of the fascist playbook. So I don't think we should be afraid of people calling themselves a radical. It means, at least it always meant to me, that we looked at the issue. We really studied the issue. We studied what's wrong with this country, what's wrong. And we came to the conclusion that capitalism leads to all the oppressions we see, and so rejected it. So I think it's a really positive label to call ourselves. And when we call each other labels, we should be careful that we can either encompass those and say, yeah, I can join with you. You don't have to believe exactly what I believe. We've got one big mess going on right now with a man who's moving rapidly to fascism and who has more ability to surveil and use law enforcement against the ordinary people than ever even imagined, I would say, a decade ago. So I think it's fine to be radical, and that's what I want to say.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler had to use Nuremberg rallies. They don't even need to use Nuremberg rallies anymore. They've got...
we should not be so afraid to say right now that, I mean, we should make no, as long as he's got one avowed racist on his cabinet or as his advisor, we should completely repudiate his administration and give it no, not in any way play along with it, not give it no credibility or legitimacy at all.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Yep. Thank you, Paul.
And,
bye.
I was going to say we got one more caller, but, if you got a real quick thing to say, we only have a couple minutes left. Go ahead.
I read the Chris Hedges article as well when it was first there. That what struck me was there's no comment about the wars, and I'm hearing all this hand-wringing going on about a president who hasn't even taken power yet. And again, people aren't talking about the wars. They're only talking about how it might impact them in the domestic realm. And I would say there's another article in Truthdig that came out about 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks ago, I can't remember. It's before the election. What's his name? Edward. He's an economist. I can't remember the name right now. But he was saying that Hillary is probably the worse evil. Trump be the lesser evil because he's more incompetent. The Hillary machine, the Clinton machine, had everything in place to start World War III.
And, I wouldn't
about,
advocate.
We're talking about making a deal with Putin, not going to war with him. So I'd say hang on, and if you're going to get upset, sue the guy. If you really want to be angry with him, if you want to do something, sue him.
Well, whether or not that will be possible is an interesting question. But thank you for that call, and we're just out of time. But So I'm not sure who the article he was referring to on Truthdig, but yeah, there are differences of opinion. I certainly wasn't advocating a Hillary Clinton presidency. I'm just talking about what we're faced with. You know, who knows? Maybe we'll be surprised. Maybe he'll his isolationism and ending adventurism abroad and pulling back. Maybe he'll shut down all the military bases around the world. Wouldn't that be great? I doubt it, considering he's surrounding himself also with some of these extremist generals. But anyway, we are completely out of time. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio. Once again, thank you all for listening. My name is Paul Rowland. Be back next week with, I believe, my co-host Jacqueline Keeler. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the opening reception for Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. The reception is an opportunity to tour the exhibit, which illustrates the Black philanthropic experience, hear from exhibit creators, and connect with social justice movement leaders from across Portland. Again, that's the opening reception for Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Good morning. It's 9.